Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And my name is Philip Coppins. And some schools in the US and across the world have already gone back to school, and some of them aren't yet, but The Spirit Revolution is back to class. And basically, this episode of The Spirit Revolution is what happens in so many elementary schools across the world. Tell us a bit about what you did in the summer. And actually, Shane, the 10-year-old is going to be confronted soon with this as well. And throughout the trip, the question was, Shane, how are you going to describe what you did in these 7 weeks of sacred France and parts of sacred Spain and parts of sacred England and Scotland?
And Belgium.
And so we're hoping that maybe we might not even get through to this in 50 minutes or so, but we will try. But of course, what we have been doing mostly in the summer months has been to lead two tours of roughly 40 people throughout the Languedoc-Roussillon area, the south of France, as part of Sacred France Tour 2011.
40 people each. Each tour had 40 people on it. So we ended up leading about 80 people over the course of these 2 weeks, which was an extraordinary thing. This is something that's really, really new to the region and hasn't been done before, which Philip's going to tell you a little more about.
Well, on the second tour, it was very interesting because there we were. It was a Saturday, and basically on the Sunday, the Tour de France, that cycling tour extraordinaire, which makes instant heroes in France, specifically those who, as Frenchmen, can win them, was coming through the region. And we were based south of Carcassonne in a tiny village called Belvienne, and about 20 minutes north of there in Limoux, which is like the local capital, so to speak. The tour was going to start. And the circus, which is the Tour de France, actually meant that, for example, we had to have special permission to come on certain roads, which we had because we were an organized tour. But on that Saturday, there we were welcoming the second group of people, and at Toulouse Airport were two buses standing next to each other, one of them which said in our letter, Sacred France Tour 2011, and the other one next to it said Tour de France 2011, the cycle tour. So we were kind of like in privileged position to be the bus next to the official VIP Tour de France bus. But it kind of underlines, I think, where we are in 2011, which is that this sacred tourism is happening more and more. People have this desire to see these places in a new light of day, to just go beyond the obvious tours which everybody is doing, and kind of like really see the landscape with new eyes, or see a landscape which you've never seen before through very specific eyes. And that is very much something which we try to do, and we think we have succeeded in doing on both tours, by giving people, some of them who'd never seen the region, some of them who had been there before, really a new perspective as to what this region was all about. And we were, of course, focusing on a specific Christian saint, Saint Mary Magdalene, and a specific period of time, Catharism, that tremendously extraordinarily barbaric crusade, which happened partly in the 12th, partly in the 13th century, as it spread through France. And really, as I introduced it, this is 200,000 people who died in a few decades. 200,000 people, most of them completely innocent. Even though we didn't visit it, Béziers is the telltale sign. At the beginning of the Cathar Crusade, the papal nuncius knocked on the door of Béziers and said, there are 222 people in these walls of your town which are suspected of being heretics. Please hand them over to us. And the people of Béziers said, no, you're not getting them. Because in our eyes, first of all, these are not heretics. We are simply unwilling to do that. And then the papal nuncius gave a very extraordinary claim, order rather, which even his commanders didn't really get. He said, kill them all. Kill everybody, all 15,000 inhabitants of Béziers.
What he said was, kill them all and God will recognize his own. And the response was, that was a response to the question that the soldiers asked, which was, if we go into Béziers, how do we tell the heretics from the Catholics? And the response was, kill them all and let God sort them out. Kill them all and God will recognize his own. And that is an expression that actually has endured for 800 years. Sadly, the American military actually uses that in the Marine Corps. I recently saw someone wearing a t-shirt a couple of days ago in the grocery store that said, kill them all and let God sort them out. And it just, it stopped me in my tracks. And I wanted to run up to this guy and grab him and say, do you have any idea what that really means? Do you understand what the historical context was? Do you understand that there was a massacre of every living human being in this town? 15,000 people, men, women, children, elderly, infants, were butchered, hacked to pieces, burned to death, because of that phrase, kill them all. And let God sort them out. You know, it's such a powerful and terrible thing, this idea of genocide. And what was, I think, so one of the things that was so important, so many amazing things happened as we were taking primarily Americans, but not all, through these areas. You know, to see these places firsthand, you really feel it. This history no longer feels like it's ancient. It doesn't feel like it's something that happened 800 years ago. As you move through these places and feel them, you are living in it. You are in the middle of that history. We don't go to Béziers, by the way. We don't go to Béziers where the massacre happened that Philip was just talking about. For a number of reasons. I personally find it extremely difficult to go there. It's a difficult, energetic place. Unlike the other places that are sacred to Catharism, where we go to places like, of course, we go to Montségur. We go to places like Minerve. And these are locations where hundreds of Cathars were actually put to death, were burned at the stake for heresy. And yet, these places have a very different energetic than Béziers. Montségur and Minerve have this beautiful energy. They hold this sense of harmony and beauty and joy. There's an extraordinary joy in these places. They hold the energy of how these people lived and not the energy of how these people died. And that's one of the things I really wanted to capture when we were putting together this itinerary. When we sat down and said, what does sacred France look like to us? Where do we want to take people who are interested in exploring this history, seeing these places that have been sacred for thousands of years, seeing this landscape where it is rumored or where legend says that Mary Magdalene once came, once lived, and once taught, and certainly where these extraordinary people who we know as the Cathars lived and taught and reveled in this thing that we know of as the Way of Love, utilizing the Book of Love and living through those extraordinary experiences. So we really wanted people to have this experience of what that could have felt like in its beauty, in its heyday, when the energy was about love and faith and community, rather than this energy of conquest and massacre. So that's why we eliminated places like Béziers and really focused on places like Montségur and Minerve.
And I think also, you know, one of the other Catholic castles which we climbed was Les Tours, where there are three castles dating from Cathar times and a fourth one which was built later. And Les Tours is one of those really beautiful places, and very few people have heard about them. But actually our name, Cabaret, let's go to the Cabaret, actually comes from there, because one of the four castles is called Cabaret. And Catharism in that region, Les Tours and another castle, Puyvert, which some people might have seen when they have watched The Nine Gates, the Roman Polanski movie starring Johnny Depp about a decade ago when it was made. Those two castles, Puyvert and Les Tours, have this very specific tradition that Catharism, the people, the lords who were Cathar lords who supported this heresy were also of the troubadour tradition. They allowed poetry, they allowed so much expression of art, which is something which, again, if you've seen other movies like The Name of the Rose, you will kind of have the hint of an idea that the church really frowned upon these things. It had, all had to be austere, it had to be grey, it had to be boring. You were here on earth not to enjoy yourself and not to be happy. If you wanted to be happy, tough luck, you had basically chosen the wrong existence. And that was so unlike Catharism. Catharism, despite what an awful lot of scientists and historians say, you know, who actually say that Cathars believe that this earth was created by Lucifer and that everything materialistic was of the devil. People of science, you know, all the evidence, most of which you have collected yourself, actually argues you are completely wrong about this, because they were troubadour traditions. They were, you know, in love with the expression of joy, of singing. And that came about in cabaret, specifically on the first tour, somewhat less on the second, when the heights of the cabaret castle was mounted, there were various songs being sung by the entire group. The first one, I believe, was Bohemian Rhapsody, and from there it went on to other classics.
But what was amazing about it is we had this extraordinary, these extraordinary groups of people, because there were two groups, and they were about 2 weeks apart. But, you know, we get up to the top of cabaret with the first group, and people were sort of overwhelmed with a desire to sing. And that, to me, was an extraordinary thing to witness, because it goes back to the idea that the energy of these places holds the way the people lived. It holds the positive vibration and not the negative vibration. And that has me thinking a lot, actually, about energy and vibration and light versus dark, that these places hold all this positive energy. Some truly terrible things happened at cabaret. Extraordinarily grotesque massacres happened in the area. The siege against cabaret, you know, was almost never ending. But prior to that, this idea of courtly love and the troubadour tradition and fantastic women who were patrons of the arts and the extraordinary artists who came there, you know, these sort of medieval salons where there was poetry and music and dancing. You know, cabaret is one of my top 10 places. If I could go back somewhere in a time machine, I would love to go back to cabaret in its heyday, when La Loba, Etienne de Penautier, was the lady of the castle, and she was, you know, holding these extraordinary salons. What I would not give to just spend one evening in one of those salons and see what it was really like and feel it. But for me to watch 21st century pilgrims, because that's what we were. This was not tourism. This is pilgrimage. These are people. All of us are people who are in these places. In a devotional manner, we are here to learn and to experience, but also to express our gratitude and our devotion to the people who've come before us and who gave so much that we may learn from them. But to see these people, you know, climb this mountain and get to the top of these ruins and climb up to the battlements and all of a sudden just burst into song and dance. And it was so contagious, and it was just one of those spontaneous moments that, you know, it's really, really hard to describe. But we had everyone, you know, from my 10-year-old who is, you know, singing Bohemian Rhapsody along with, you know, the other people in the group, and it went through. Everyone had different songs and everyone had different dances, but even the people who you would think of were more shy were moved up there. They were moved to dance and they were moved to celebrate. And that is, again, the energy of this place, the energy of this troubadour spirit lives and deserves to be celebrated.
And on the first trip, because it was just before really the main tourist season, but the second one was in full tourist season, and so we didn't have Les Tours all to ourselves pretty much as we had on the first tour. But on the second tour, there were lots of people who came up and kind of like said, oh, we heard you singing, this was great, and even a French family who basically joined in and started singing with us. And one of the things, which is that, you know, we are a group of 40 people, it is an imposing group, and you come there And you have this group mentality. And so just the fact that people felt comfortable in joining in kind of like outweigh, how should I put this? Like the power of the place outweighs any emotional fear you might have of joining in with what foreigners and strangers are doing. But when you were talking about this land holding the energy, several months ago, it might even have been last year, when we were ahead of Sacred France and we were planning it, we did a show on Sacred France and why France was as a place so sacred and why it was so special. And we actually came to the conclusion, I think, there that it was the place which held the energy, that there was something about these places whereby history somehow is imprinted upon them, where somehow there is a gateway, so to speak, of the past which still links to the present, and that the past is very much present into the present, that there is not this dissociation between different eras, but really where time just all melts into one. And we already touched upon it, but one of the other places where we went to was Minerve. And probably Minerve, and only this realization really came after the two tours had finished, but Minerve was a place of real magic, 100% real strange things happening. On the first trip, we actually went to Minerve on the first day. And so people had seen the medieval city of Carcassonne in all of its beauty. It was a very beautiful day. And in the afternoon, we went to Minerve. And eventually, we got there because there were roadworks and various other obstacles between us and our destination. But when we got there, we went down into the gorge. And it is in this gorge that really the massacre of Minerve happened, because Minerve is named after Minerva. It's a goddess of Greek Roman tradition, and basically this was a place where the Cathars came to live the way. There were fortifications, but basically everybody who lived there believed that they were going to be left alone because it wasn't a vital place of power. It was just a village, a little town in the middle of nowhere, and that is what they wanted. That is why they went there.
It's very much off the beaten track. So, it's one of those places that if you were going to go and create a community somewhere and you wanted to be left alone, this is a place that you would be able to do it. But I wanted to interject here just for a second and say that it is called Minerve, after Minerva, because there were temples there to the goddess of wisdom, to the divine feminine, to essentially Sophia. And what we see over and over again with the Cathar people is that the places that become sacred to them, truly extraordinarily important to what they are living and what they're teaching, are all ancient sites with some relationship to divine feminine. Whether it is the Belisama, wife of God association that we find in Monsegur, the Isis associations that we find in the Aude Valley, or this Minerva, who is just the Roman version of Sophia, Isis, etc., in their time. We find over and over again that the Cathars were strong about settling in places that had ancient divine feminine wisdom traditions. And this particular one was so powerful in that regard, but also so remote that I think that they felt that this was a safe place to create what would essentially become their utopian community. Because that's what I believe Minerve really was. This is the one brief shining moment of Catharism in so many ways. This is a place where 100% of the people were living the way of love for a while. And it was really a center for teaching and for intense study of the way.
And also, throughout what really the church was aiming at were perfects who were preaching, who were trying to convert Catholics and people that they should abandon Catholicism and become Cathars. And those were the primary targets. In Minerve, even though, as you say, there was this study aspect and this creation of future leavers, on the surface, it just seemed to be that people were living there and not really going out so much as preaching. It was more living the way rather than sending out missionaries across the south of France to do this thing. So there was this glimmer of hope, I always felt in Minerve, that they wouldn't be as massacred as they were. But nevertheless, Minerve stands as one of the brutal massacres because everybody was rounded up. They were tied together. They were led into the gorge and they were executed in a most horrific way. And so we went into the gorge to the place where pretty much everybody is in agreement where this massacre happened. There's only, you know, you can only be wrong by 20 yards, so to speak, as to where it would have happened. And we were also fortunate that in France it has been an extremely dry spring, which means that the water in the gorge of the river is basically completely absent. So we could go to places and just sit there whenever we have been there before, there is definitely some sort of water to be found there. And so with the first group, Isabel, one of our guides, she basically asked everybody to be silent. And what I have said to you guys just here, I was also said to the people on the trip. And so they had an awful lot of material to work with to kind of like make that part of their thoughts in the few minutes of silence. And when the few minutes of silence were up, basically what everybody realized was that it wasn't just us 30, 40 people who had been silent. Everything had been silent. There was no wind making a noise in the trees. There were no birds singing. There was nothing. It had just been 5-6 minutes of total silence. And so on the second trip, we had to slightly adapt our itinerary because of the Tour de France. We couldn't go to Minerve on that Sunday because of the Tour de France going along there as well. And so when we did go to Minerve, it was in tourist season, and the hope of having that silence was basically impossible because there were tourists everywhere, including small children who were obviously enjoying themselves. So this was not going to happen. Instead, we were treated to a far more bizarre phenomenon, which was that it started to rain. Now, you might say, okay, that's not that unusual. But the one thing I have not mentioned so far is that there was not a single cloud in the sky. It was raining from a blue sky. Now, it wasn't an intense rain, but it was intense enough. This was, you know, a rain where you could see the drops fall for about 2 to 3 minutes. And throughout, there was no cloud in the sky, overhead or nearby, which was able to cause this rain. And it happened precisely once again when we were asking people to be silent and to meditate on what had been happening.
Well, you know, something extraordinary happens in that gorge in Minerve when you go to this place where the execution site, where the 200 Cathar leaders were burned here. It's almost like it is a place of time slip. I think that's probably the closest I can come to describing it. And it's really unlike any other place. When you're there, something, especially when you're there in a group, when there is a concentrated energy. I've been there in smaller groups before. I've been there with 3 or 4 people. I've been there with, you know, 10 to 15. And of course, in these situations, we were there with 40 plus. But there's some kind of magic that is triggered by this sort of group consciousness that happens. And I do feel like it's a time slip. For those moments that you're in this space, you are out of time. You are not in whatever day or time it is, the 21st century. You are somewhere else. And I really feel in both cases, whether it was in the first week when we had that extraordinary silence, and I mean nothing. What broke it was all of a sudden birds started singing and the cicadas started clicking, and all of a sudden there was sound everywhere. So it went from this absolute stillness to this cacophony of sound. So you were really struck by the contrast of having been for 5 or 6 minutes in a place almost like a vacuum where there was absolutely nothing, but it was a beautiful nothingness. It was an extraordinary stillness, unlike anything I think I've ever experienced before, to all of a sudden being sort of thrust back into the here and now. So you had a definite sense of we were just somewhere else altogether. And then in the second group, when the rain happened, you had a definite sense of being having been somewhere else, because it just didn't make sense. All of a sudden, you were in this clear blue sky, and it was getting quite warm, and a lot of us were taking off our sweaters. And because we were starting to really feel the heat down in the middle of that gorge, you're unprotected, and so the sun is fairly brutal down there, especially in the summer. It gets very dry and very hot very quickly. And then all of a sudden, this amazing sort of misty rain starts to happen out of nowhere. So I don't know if you feel that it's time slip-ish, but that is kind of how it feels to me.
Yes, it's definitely, as I said, like it's more like time. To me, it's more like time merging, like this timelessness aspect of it. Like whatever happened there, like created a zone where time doesn't really matter, where you can just contact the past and that energy will always be there. And, you know, it's a place where 200 people were brutally murdered. But as people on both doors said, Minerve doesn't feel sad. There is this happiness about it. And a lot of feedback after specifically the second tour was that the people felt that that they realized that they had their moment of glory, their ways, their few years, for some, a few decades, of leading and living a way, of living a life which was full, which was everything they ever wanted to do. And, you know, everybody knows that your time on this earth comes to an end at some point. And the fact that it was going to be brutal, they kind of like had accepted that, but they were more aware of the good things which they had experienced there than of the horrible things which were going to happen to them down that gorge. And so an awful lot of people experienced the joy that as they were let down into that gorge, the people who were going in that gorge to die were actually not fearful of their death, but happy about the fact that they had lived a good life. And an awful lot of kind of like, you know, atmosphere of Minerve definitely is of that joyous nature. And just about the time thing, there is a bridge in Minerve, which used to be the bridge where most tourists came into until a few last year when the new car park was built. And now most tourists come via another way. But the bus parking still takes you over the old bridge. And there's a story about how as you approach the middle of this bridge, you somehow leave the normal world and enter a special world. And that somehow time itself either propels you or pushes you back and forth between the two. And that there's this kind of optical illusion present within that bridge, which kind of aids this sensation. And definitely walking that bridge, subconsciously or not, does give you that sense of like, you know, Minerve is this outcrop of a rock surrounded on three sides by the gorge. And you definitely feel that kind of enclosed nature of Minerve. The energy of Minerve is local to the village itself. You don't experience it on the other side of the bridge. It's there and only there. And, you know, it goes back thousands of years. This has been a sacred place for so many millennia. And even though today it is notorious for the Cathar massacre which happened there, it has been sacred and a place of wisdom for so many years. And definitely for those who were on the trip with us, that was experienced in two beautiful ways and two different ways on both occasions by the elements of nature really going berserk and doing and creating an extraordinary event, which, you know, I definitely will remember for the rest of my life.
Oh, absolutely. You know, for me, having been in these places many, many times, and you too, it's really magical to go there with people, to bring people into these places that have never been there and experience it through their eyes for the first time. And you know, this whole concept of doing these sacred France tours originally was a little bit daunting for me. You know, I was kind of dragged kicking and screaming into it initially because people have been asking me for 5 years to take people on these guided, these visits, these retreats and tours to the places that I write about. And I wanted to do it because I know how transformational and life-changing this region is. I know what the energy of these places not only can, but absolutely will do to you if you are open to it. And I have seen that in smaller scale with my own friends and family. I took a small group there in 2006 and watched it happen then. So, you know, that part of me that wanted to help facilitate that for people, that wanted to gift people with this experience that has been so life-changing and transformational for me, wanted to do it. But this whole concept of sort of, you know, dealing with these huge numbers and, you know, what kind of, you know, logistics and personalities and, you know, I was kind of overwhelmed by it. But I have to say that it was the most extraordinary experience for both of us. It was so much fun and it was so beautiful. Yes, it was exhausting, but it was exhausting because there was so much energy expended, but in the best way possible. And to be able to watch people have these experiences and discover these things about themselves, about the places, and most of all about each other, was so miraculous. The thing that I don't think I anticipated, the big surprise for me, was watching people come together as a community, was watching these groups gel and watching how in the course of 7 days, people who had entered into this place as strangers left as family. And I mean committed relationships, friendships, lifetime bonds, maybe many lifetimes bonds were made and cemented on these trips. You know, I watch it on Facebook and I'm in the middle of some of these interactions and we have people who met who are now starting businesses together. We have people who met on the tours who are writing books together. It's extraordinary what's happening. And what I witnessed that was really, I think, the most poignant for me was how many people were on these trips who came partially because in their day-to-day normal lives, they're not really understood. They don't have people in their immediate families or communities who understand how passionate they are about their spirituality, about exploring this kind of history, about looking at these esoteric mysteries. And they feel kind of alone. And so a lot of them, this was a big step for them. They wanted to be in a place where they could possibly express this or meet other like-minded and like-spirited people. And watching that happen, watching these people find themselves in a place that was so safe for them to be wholly themselves and completely authentic and ask any question and not be afraid that someone was going to think that they were crazy or weird or abnormal. That for me was, you know, that was a highlight. That was something that I did not anticipate. I didn't see coming and was just a joyous thing to watch like-minded people come together in this place that was so nurturing for all of these things that they've had in their heads and in their spirits for such a long time.
Because most of the people on this trip do have to, you know, like, abide by, I think, what most of our listeners and most people in the Western world have to do, which is you are locked into a regime which is what we call Western civilization. And that is something which didn't exist in the 13th century. You know, money as we have it today is only really an invention of the 14th, 15th century and made its road ever onwards after. But it didn't exist there and then. And I think one of the most extraordinary things was that we also showed them on the trip how this heretical nature of Catharism survived. You know, history books again will tell you that Catharism was successfully defeated shortly after the fall of Montségur when another few Cathar castles fell, and then the church basically said, okay, Catharism is eradicated now, this is the end. Well, you will also know, if you're a bit of a Cathar expert, that that isn't the case, that there was a second, the third wave, whereby the Inquisition went after Cathar priests like Pierre Rottier and Guillaume Balibaste, who were preaching still in that region. And so when we're talking about cities like, towns like Arc, definitely people who've read Kathleen's books will know that this is a very important setting for the expected one. In towns like Arc, people in the 20th century were practicing Cathars. People like Theodore Rocher, who was the mayor of Arc, has often been referred to as one of the last surviving Cathars. He lived in a Cathar way. Each morning he went to a site near his town, which was an ancient site dedicated to Greek and Roman goddesses, and if the archaeological evidence is to believe, even further back, going to Egyptian times. So all of these places have been power places, and Catharism was one of them, but it didn't end at the fall of Munzegur. It continued up until the 20th century, and it continues up until 2011, because what was happening was that because of time things and Tour de France and various other things, the schedule for Trip 1 was slightly different from Trip 2. And Trip 2 was going to be in Rennes-le-Château on July 22nd, feast day of Mary Magdalene, the patron saint of Rennes-le-Château. So various things were going to happen in the village, and including one which was a concert by a very local and gifted musician, and we're going to play some of her music at the end of this show. But because this was scheduled to be July 22nd, for Trip 1, there wasn't going to be a July 22nd. And so, by a series of coincidences, which are no coincidence at all,
co-created incidents,
we had the artist's family and everybody involved a chance, which is not chance, coincidence in Rennes-le-Château when we were visiting it on the second day of our first trip. And basically, the family said, well, okay, come to our home. And, she will play there for you. To which we said, we are 40 people. It's kind of like, yes, come over and bring a few friends along. But nobody really brings 40 people along. Not even in Hollywood comedy movies do you see them showing up at a house party with 40 friends. But yes, that was precisely what they wanted us to do. And so we made some changes to the schedule so that we could include this happening. And basically, we went with 40 people to the tiny village of Brunac. We had to make sure that the bus was able to get there. We were welcomed. Our group sat in the reception room. There was music being played, and the entire village came and sat outside and listened to this music as well.
And it takes a village to produce a concert, let me tell you, because these people were extraordinary, and the welcome that we received in this village was just beautiful from the family and the people. But they got 40 of us into that room, and that was also from borrowing chairs. And I mean, everyone had come together to make this happen so that there would be plenty of chairs and there would be an ability, you know, for us to bring everybody in there and have this same experience. And it was all done strictly out of the beauty and the kindness of their hearts and their desire to share with us, to share the gifts of this beautiful, beautiful young woman named Devayani, who plays the piano like an angel. And she's an extraordinary girl. She's absolutely angelic to look at and certainly angelic to hear. Her family's magnificent. The community that supports her in this mystical, inspired music that she plays. She writes all of her own compositions, and they're all sort of divinely inspired. She's really a magical little being. And you know, we all sat there listening to Deva and, you know, enjoying being in this village and realizing that this is the Cathar revival. We're in the middle of it, that in the 21st century, these people are living in the same spirit as the Cathars. And having been going back and forth to this region for 16 years now, since 1995, it's so exciting to me to see how much is coming back in terms of this spirit of Catharism is really, really alive and well and growing and thriving.
Absolutely. And, on the first trip, as I said, we were invited to Brunac. We were then invited to a lovely area just outside of Brunac, which is owned by the family of Devayani and some friends of hers. And basically, it's a wonderful little site. You can almost see the fairies. It's a kind of like a fairy glen with river down and some fields where they grow their own plants. And it's very much a community effort of farming. And there we were invited to kind of like have a few drinks and kind of like just wander around. And out of the blue, her family basically says, "So what have you got in store for you over the next few days?" And, well, one of them was climbing Mount Segur. So they decided that they had to be with us in climbing Mount Segur. And this was actually also happening on the second trip when weather conditions were pretty much atrocious. But this family was going to be there when we were climbing Mount Segur. And, you know, Devayani's mother is not elderly, but not young. And there was some doubt as to whether she was going to be able to make the climb. But in the end, she got up there amongst the first.
She got up there better than most people.
And when she was up there, she basically let out, I think, like, you know, a victory cry of all Cathars.
Oh, she got up. She's so beautiful. This Sarah is her name. And Sarah got up to the top of Mount Segur and she threw up her arms and she said, "We are here and we are alive." And it was beautiful. It was very much this Cathar revival moment. You know, we're back. This concept of love and faith and community and all of us coming together in the spirit that is alive and that will never die. And we are here to bring it back. But this sense of camaraderie and extended spirit family and community, I mean, we were all not just were, are still so high on it. It just, you know, it's an amazing thing. I just, my beautiful friend, Susan, who was on the first trip, posted something on my Facebook page a couple of days ago, and she said, "You didn't warn me about the side effects, you know, the side effects of going on Sacred France, were these withdrawals, this, you know, desire to be back there and, you know, feel this again and be connected to it and the people and the place and the, you know, the magic, you know, how do you get over that?" And, you know, and that's what we're all feeling right now. We're all feeling this extraordinary blessing that we had all being together in these places at this time. And a lot of us are planning to go back. Certainly you and I are planning on, we will be doing more Sacred France trips in 2012. Anyone who is interested in participating in these journeys and this magic that is happening, if you go to our Sacred France website, which is sacredfrance.com, and sign up for the newsletter, we'll send you the information for the 2012 trips. They sell out immediately, so if you decide you want to do it, let us know, and then we can hold your space. But we're going to try to expand our Sacred France offerings for 2012 and maybe go to a couple of new places, as well as keep this sort of classic Cathar itinerary, which I think we'll always have to, you know, we'll always have to run that at least once a year, because it's just such a special opportunity to be in these places in with this sense of community.
And we're heading back there, of course, in October. But Devayani is interesting for two more reasons. First of all, on the second trip, July 22nd, in the Garden of Marie in Rennes-le-Château, she was playing. And at one point, actually, the birds were joining in. The birds were beginning to sing with her. And it was just an extraordinary moment to kind of like hear these creatures of nature joining in with the music being created in the garden. And not only were they doing it from afar, from the trees, they actually came very near to her, very close, at her feet and around her. And then they kind of like, you know, flew away again. But
it was like watching Snow White at the piano. It was so sweet. But I've never actually seen anything like it. The birds were flying in and dancing around on the patio around her and chirping in time with the music. It was an amazing thing to behold.
And, you know, she's one of those angelic creatures, as you were saying. She was three or four when she saw somebody at a concert playing the piano, and she said, "That's what I'm going to do." And less than 20 years later, that's precisely what she is doing. And she is largely self-taught, but also, you know, she is in the same league as so many of the angelics. One other person we're going to mention just now, who basically had, you know, in their cases, encounters with angels. And the people said, well, I can't paint, or I can't do this, or I can't do that. And basically the angel said, that's none of your problem. We will tell you how to do these things. And for the rest, you know, Andrew Leakey comes to mind specifically. They were given the instruments through which to do their service, their divine service, their art service to the divine. And, of course, what the first group didn't get, but the second group did get, was the extraordinary Angels Sanctuary, which has opened in Alet-les-Bains. And it just underlines you, one of the things which we didn't realize when we were doing and starting this thing, because we were so focused on getting it done and kind of like making it a great experience. But then when we were finishing the first tour, the feedback from Peter van Dursen, our local tour operator there, and from various other corners, what we began to realize is this: the Languedoc-Roussillon is a region which has no economy. It's an extraordinary, beautiful region, but the only thing which it will possibly make its survival is tourism. And now there are tourists, but these are tourists who come there with their own car. And basically, for a region to survive from tourism, you need far more. You need the big buses. You need the organized travel industry to come there. And the travel industry there is only limited to Carcassonne. Even though everybody's heard of Rennes-le-Château, on average, about 150,000 people each year come to Rennes-le-Château. Places like Rosslyn Chapel have, you know, more people than that. A place like Edinburgh Castle has 2 million visitors each year. Really, to survive from tourism, you need to go over the 500,000 mark per year. And that is something which that region really faces as its challenge, and that's the challenge of its economic survival. And one of the reasons why tourism doesn't happen in that region is because people, the tourism industry and the region, is felt to be not equipped for handling anything over 20 people. And so when we got there with 30 plus 40 people, one of the things was that even though we wanted to go to very beautiful restaurants, sometimes they would just say, we can't cope with 40 people. So our challenge and Peter's challenge was to find good restaurants, good accommodation, which is able to work with this amount of people. You know, organize where the bus can go and where the bus can't go. Sometimes on these roads, that's not a given. If you want to go somewhere, you know, specifically where we want to go, it involves advanced work as to where the bus can go and how to go there. So all of these things were done, and we were really pioneers in the sense that we showed that A, there is an interest of foreign tourists in this region to come there, but also that, you know, it is doable, that the region is equipped to handle it right now, and that really the next step is just a sense of growth, a sense of expansion. But that in future investors on tourism in this region should really look towards it, because it is doable. And that is something which we only realized, as I said, as the tours went on. But coming back to what we were talking about, which is that on the second tour, one of the people who really are trying to do something extraordinary is Laurie and Eugene with the Angel Sanctuary in Alet-les-Bains. And we're definitely going to have them on one of our future Spirit Revolution shows, because their story is extraordinary. But they had to convince the local mayor that what they were doing was going to be attracting tourists to his town, which on paper looks quite suitable for tourism, but in reality doesn't happen. You know, there are some hotels, but there's a casino even. But it doesn't really bring the tourism into the town, or makes the town prosper from the tourists which are in the town. So the proposal which they had put forward to get the Angel Gallery going was that it would bring in tourists. And Laurie and Eugene basically said, by the way, there will be buses coming to our sanctuary. And basically the mayor said, you know, okay, we get the fact this is, you know, you should be able to do this, you will bring in tourism. But this idea of a bus coming to my town, and specifically to something which is so new as your endeavor, I don't see that happening.
Well, and I want to back up here for a minute and talk about what the Angel Sanctuary is. I believe it's now called the Angel Gallery. Laurie Coffey is this beautiful Irish woman who tells an extraordinary story about her life. And we will have her on, so you will hear her story. But she basically, in a time of crisis, got a message from the angels saying, paint us. And she said, I don't paint. And they said, oh, yes, you do. And oh, yes, she does. Laurie creates the most extraordinary paintings of angels. And she has this gallery, and calling it an art gallery does not do it justice. It is a sanctuary. It is a temple. It is a place of such extraordinary peace and harmony and spiritual power. Each one of these angels that she paints has some kind of essence to it. So, for example, there is the angel of healing, or the angel of grief, or the angel of miracles. Each one of the angels has a type of energy. When you stand in front of the painting of that angel, you are affected, you are impacted by whatever that energy is. And it's an amazing thing to witness. And in the middle of this space is this source, this fountain, this natural spring of water that comes from this ancient source. So what they've done, they've created something that is, you know, of its own right, just because of what it is, a beautiful, powerful experience, but they've combined it with this extraordinary PowerPoint on Earth. And so being there is truly magical. And it was an amazing thing for us to watch people, you know, what was fascinating for me was the big, strong, macho guys that we had on our second group were the most profoundly affected by this angel sanctuary. I mean, it got to them. It really, you know, they had profound reactions to it. And across the board, people said to us, oh my gosh, we wish we could have spent more time there. This was a highlight. So of course we're taking everybody we can there now, because it is so profoundly impactful. But again, it goes back to this Cather revival that is happening in the region here now in the 21st century. People who are really committed to this way of sharing and sharing their faith and creating community and working together for this type of, you know, healing and consciousness raising.
Absolutely. And you know, it's that combination of beautiful landscape and sacred experiences, which is precisely why so many people are there. But you know, Catharism isn't something from the past. We don't have time to go into it, but the other tradition which we kept highlighting was this tradition of priests who were there around the turn of the 20th century, who were building extraordinary things because they were trying to bring in pilgrims to experience this tradition for themselves as well, and used Mary Magdalene as the hook, as the symbol through which to tell the story, very much like you know, we are telling it as well on our trips, tours, pilgrimages. But unfortunately, we're running out of time, so we definitely want to show you a piece of Deviani's music, which we will do shortly. But there is so much more to say. We haven't spoken about Uncle Salvatore Dali. We haven't spoken about the magical stones of Brittany, Carnac, Chartres, Belgium, Stirling Castle in Scotland. So many more things. So we will be back next week with more of our summer holiday special program, Spirit Revolution. But for now, I will tell you some practical information, which is that if you want to hear anything again, please go to thespiritrevolution.com. You can go to iTunes. You can go to the bbsradio.com archives, where you will get our shows as well. We will leave you with excerpts from Deviani's music. But until next time,
the truth against the world.